Is that roping contest 4:30? 4 o'clock, and we have once again fabulous prizes, and people of all ages are welcome, and we'll do it right here on the stage. We do the roping contest, so it's a chance to learn roping and get a fabulous prize. Excuse me. We're gonna try it just with this cordless mic. I think we can do that. On my immediate left here, your right, is Mr. Willie Johns from the Brighton Reservation. Like I said, he's the outreach coordinator for the Atatiki Museum down at the Big Cypress. I think what we did yesterday might work. If we could start with a condensed history of 400 years of history in say, 5 minutes of Seminole cattle ranching.
If you were here yesterday, you heard a fine historical presentation by a professor at a local college in this area, Joe Ackerman, and he talked about in the late 1870s how the Seminoles rejuvenated the cattle industry here in Florida. And what happened was after the Rancho La Chua and the mission period, when the Spanish had ranches across from St. Augustine to Tallahassee, was the red sticks and the white sticks were at civil war with each other in the southeast. So Andy Jackson comes in early 1812, the war 1818, the first Seminole Wars fought. By then, there are Seminoles in Florida in the late 1700s with large cattle herds, because what had happened was Florida was left pretty well vacant, and the cattle was there and pretty taken and pretty much free, and the horses were there, and so they started managing the herds, and the late 1700s, you see the Seminoles start to get into international trade with Cuba, and because there's documents and letters that are written by the Cuban governor thanking cowkeeper for cattle. And from that point on, war broke out. The Second Seminole War broke out, and that was a 7-year war, which took most of the interest away from the Seminoles, because most of the military documents that you read about the Second Seminole War, the major battles, you see large herds of cattle being confiscated, probably near 10,000 head of cattle that the Seminoles once had in Florida are now militaries confiscating it, because the Indian Removal Act was in effect, and the Indian Removal Act said that any Native American that was east of the Mississippi were no longer wanted here, because it was against the law. That was the first time immigration law was used. So it's interesting that we talk about the immigration laws and how that works. I was at Plymouth Rock this past year, and I saw the big rock, the Plymouth Rock, and I was talking to a little ranger girl, and I was telling her, this is a sad place, isn't it? And she goes, well, no, what's so sad about this place? I said, well, this is where immigration showed its ugly face and failed, because Native Americans should have done something right then, took care of the problem. So, but anyhow, the Seminoles have been involved, with the cattle industry here in Florida pretty much since its infancy up until maybe a little after the Third Seminole War, we kind of all together got away from the cattle industry because it wasn't very good to us. Rangeland, open range, and we were shooting at each other's white pine ears, everybody fighting for grazing, and it would just turned out really bad for us. A couple of our young Indian warriors were hung for cattle rustling, and it just wasn't very conducive for us, and so we pretty much walked away from the cattle industry until reservation time, and then at the reservation era in the early 1900s, a lot of things had to be, a lot of agreements had to be unraveled so that people like my great uncle Charlie Miko would even consider being even cattle owners. So there was a lot of mistrust between Native Americans and any kind of policies that were laid before them. So the cattle today is we have on the Brighton and the Big Cypress, and then we have large land holdings in down in the Tamiami, and then we bought some property, and then we have a lot of lease land. So we probably in the neighborhood we carry around 10,000 head of mama cows, and back in the day we used to raise our own bulls, but found that it's cheaper to buy man's best bulls. But there's a lot of argument over that, you know, because I always thought that, you know, Florida bred bulls for Florida cattle, you know, instead of Texas bred for Florida, doesn't seem to work as well. So all in all, you know, I was telling Norman, I said, I've been nice to the non-Indians here, but about telling the history. But all in all, the success of the cattle industry here in Florida is it's from the blood of the Seminoles, the cuffs of them. And, you know, because the pioneers wanted the cattle, they wanted it, and they fought. We had the best lands. We were pushed off into the Everglades. So we were really put in a hole, and we had to dig our way out. And today we're made this business a success as to what it is today.
And for people who don't know, what can you tell us how Seminoles rank in terms of Florida cattle ranching? Are they in the top five, three? Do you have an idea?
In the county or state?
State. Third, we're number three in the cattle, and our neighbor is number one.
Likes Brothers. Well, there's Deseret also up there in Osceola County. But the reason there's maybe minor differences of opinion on this, because I've talked to the Cattlemen's Association, I've talked to the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, and a lot of it has to do with how this stuff is reported. But certainly the Seminoles are in anywhere from top three to top five, depending who's talking whose figures, and the Deseret and the Likes Brothers are right up there. So, and the Likes Brothers are right next door to the Brighton Reservation. Bill, you want to take it over and maybe get Norman to talk a little?
I don't know that. It's tough getting Norman to talk, but when he does, he's got something to say. And one of the things that interests me, you've talked about the Seminoles are major cattle producers in the state of Florida, and you've got, as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, but you've got your major herds on the Brighton Reservation and the Big Cypress Reservation. And I was always interested in the way it worked, because you've got several families that have their cattle there, and they're all worked by one cattle crew. Is that right?
Yeah.
All right, Norman, could you tell us about what the cattle crew does on the Brighton Reservation? Just number of people in it and sort of your average duties.
Yeah, we got about 42 cattle owners on the reservation. Everybody's got different earmarks, and they want to work them every day, seem like. And we get up daylight to dark, and some people says, no, we don't want to work them day, so we got to go find somebody else who want to work cows. And it goes on and on, just like that. Yeah, there's 42 different owners, and everybody's got different earmark and brands, so you got to know what you're doing.
Well, yeah, Bob wants to know, how big are the herds?
You got to have 75 and above. And like me, I got 300 head myself.
Okay, and about how many cowboys are on the Brighton crew?
Well, they come about six or seven. Sometimes they don't show up, and just be three or four of us.
I'm sure it increases the workload when there's only three or four. But I know that I was privileged to be able to go on a roundup with Norman and the Brighton cattle crew, and I was just fascinated at the many tasks they had to perform. It takes a lot of work to look after cattle. So, Norman, if you could, tell us about the different chores that you have to do, from marking them and vaccinating them and feeding them and bunching them and moving them. That's a lot, but see if you can tell us about it.
Yeah, we raise our own 2-year-old heifers. We feed and take care of them. They're about 500, 600 of them, and we got our own yearling pasture. It's about the same amount there where we just rotate back the cows back to the herds, to the owners. And most time, our calves are falling now. They fall till Christmas. In January, we put our bulls out 120 days, then we get them up, then we start all over again. Vaccination, that's end of February. That lasts about 2 months.
Well, you said that the cows are falling now. I'm not. Does that mean they're clumsy or are they giving birth?
They're having calves now.
Okay, and so you have to medicate them and mark them and stuff, but what about maintaining the pastures? I mean, how much time do you put into repairing the fences?
It takes, well, some people don't worry about it, but they call me, so I got to go there and do all their work for them. But I don't mind it. You know, that's what I love to do. It takes a lot of time.
Okay, and what about rotating them from pasture to pasture? Could you explain that for the folks?
Yeah, there are some people, they rotate them cows. They're leaving them about a week and a half or a quarter and a half, much water or grass they got. They do that every 2 weeks. They probably about 40 of them does that, rotates them. The rest of them just leave their gates open like I do.
Let them go graze on their neighbor's lawns. Well, so how often do you rotate the herds?
Well, they try to do it every week, 2 weeks. The main people weren't really interested in rotating their cows.
And so do you just round them up and drive them to the next pasture?
Yeah, most times the people just blow their horn and cows run to the gate and they just push them all over.
I don't know if it's quite that easy.
Of course, most people are familiar with branding cattle as a way to identify them, identify the owner. And another way is earmarking. You want to run over and get it? We have some rubber cow's ears, or not real cow's ears. But we'll bring them over and show you about earmarking. But, Norman, you might be the guy to tell us, why would you want to do both? I mean, if you mark their ears, why do you need to brand them?
Well, we're getting a chip put in their ear. We don't know where they go in the world. See, when they slaughter them. Yep.
Bob said earlier that cowboys will face all kinds of hazards, but the scariest thing they have to face is a microphone.
What are you going to do?
Tell us about marking the cattle.
Yeah, this man here got, well, before the tag comes out, we used to mark these calves. It used to look like this. Then when the owner said we got a mark, so we put a mark in their ears, something like this, and there's 42 owners. So you got to mark them ears all kind of ways. Then we got this little computer chip. Then that, some people won't mark them because we put that chip in their ear, and then we put their initials or the brand on that computer, and it's on this chip here.
Well, I never knew much about working cattle until I started hanging out with Norman. and I always thought you identified cattle by branding them, and they do, but they said the advantage of marking the cow's ears is when the cow holds its head up, you can see how it's been marked because its ear is flopping out there, and they notch them, trim the ends off of them, and cut. Well, Norman, you know about the different ways the ears are marked. Can you explain that?
Well, there's a certain way most of the people's got steers, and they just put a swallow fork in their ear, and the heifer, they just put under a bit until they get older. When you cull them, when they want to keep, they know which one.
You said a swallow fork. Now, what's that?
Just nip the ear on the end. You pinch it like that, get your pocket knife, cut it, and it'll be a swallow fork.
Makes a V cut into the ear. And you mentioned the underbit. Was that what it was?
Yeah, the underbit. And you get your knife, you make a little underbit. You pinch the ear like that and cut it.
And I've seen them mark the ears on the cattle, on the calves anyhow, and they're not going easily. They're putting up a struggle.
Of course, this hasn't been brought up, but they use just a pocket knife, like a Barlow knife or whatever, and of course, they're constantly resharpening the thing because it does get dull, but you want to get a nice clean cut. Even some pliers made for that purpose. Uh-huh. And this electronic tag that's right in the center, you may have heard about that in the news. That's been, especially when mad cow disease came out, I think that's about the time these tags came out, or just before, but certainly got more publicity during the mad cow disease thing. And these tags enabled you to track, it's like a barcode, you track basically everything, the animal's parentage, the male and female, their nutrition, their inoculation history, vaccination history, all that stuff. You can read that barcode in a minute. So, you know, here you have a combination of the modern high tech. And by the way, the Seminoles, I believe this is true, at least in Florida, are the first beef producers to go 100% with the electronic ear tags. There are others that have some of them, and some are dragging their feet and don't want any part of it. But the Seminoles are going 100%. They also sell all their cattle by a video. They don't take their cattle to a livestock market. And so they have the tradition of the branding and the earmarking, but then they have the modern technology of the electronic tags and the video auction. And what else am I forgetting? That's about covers it. There is a tradition I observe. Maybe I can get it started. You all can talk a little bit. Because there are, I think it's 44 or something like that, families that own cattle at the Brighton Reservation, and about half that many more at Big Cypress. When they have their annual roundup, they round up the cattle, gather the cattle that they're going to ship. And, you know, it's all hands on deck. All the families come out. Every able-bodied man and boy and women. There's women are maybe might be more involved in cattle ranching among the Seminoles than generally. There's a lot of women involved and been in it a long time. And, yeah, a lot of women cattle owners, and they're working either helping gather the cattle or in the weighing process. What's her name? Is an expert on earmarks. Was over there. Forget her name now. Yeah, no. I forget. Has one long braid. Can't remember her name. Anyhow, they're right in the middle of it. But one nice, who's ever cattle, they ship about 5 or 6 herds a day, gather and ship. And the people whose cattle are being shipped that day, they're responsible for feeding everybody the noontime meal. And that's pretty nice. So they have this big gathering under the tent. They're feeding, 100 people, 75 people. And the 5 or 6 families that are involved, whose cattle are being shipped, all the kids and everything gather, and it's a big community meal there. Is there any traditional foods that go with that, or is it kind of just whatever anybody wants to provide? Can either one of you answer that?
Well, we like to have gopher and fry bread and curlews, and we might shoot an eagle or two, maybe, you know. No, we, you know, it's beef stew, sandwiches, pizza, whatever the girls want to bring, that's what they have. I know it's kind of an insult to have hot dogs, though. Yeah.
But the last day they had hot dogs and bologna, really.
Yeah, well, sometimes the cowboys kind of like that, because after a while, it seemed like half of the meal is fried chicken or some kind of chicken, you know. So for the week, you get kind of tired of chicken a la king, barbecue chicken, rotisserie, you know, just there's 100 ways you can cook chicken, and we have it that week. And then some days somebody might bring cold cuts, and it's kind of nice. So, yeah. But traditional foods, you know, we're kind of like you guys now, you know, and most of the older ones are gone, and traditional foods could have been, you know, we don't even hardly have softy there, or fry bread, or smoke alligator or something, you know. So all in all, it's pretty Americanized, our, you know, our dinners and what have you. But you alluded to the marketing. The way we market our cattle is through the internet, our video. And we were one of the pioneers that started that with Superior Livestock. We were the beginning ground roots investors in that organization, and shoot, it's been about 25 years now, and yeah, and we used to sell goats and lambs on video, and now it's they sell whatever you want. If you watch RFD TV, you know, they sell horses, they sell bulls, you know, I bet you they sell cars if they let them, you know. So we also sell our cattle like that and on the video, and it is supposed to be more money. We don't know that, you know, but seemed like sometimes the livestock market's higher. So, and it seemed like the market's higher when we do sell our calves. So it's kind of different. It just both kind of weighs itself out.
Well, of course, another advantage would be is that I've heard that there are those that say the livestock markets are only good for two things: selling junk cattle and spreading disease. So selling by video, you don't have the disease problem. You know, I remember the woman I was thinking of was Mary Jean Kunis. And she's known for Hiller. She's got a pretty good memory for earmarks. And she told me when I interviewed her, it was surprising that she said it was in the late 1960s before they had horses. They used to gather their cattle by foot. And do you guys remember that sort of thing? No, you go back to horses way back.
Their photos, they actually had cattle before we did. Down in the Cypress, because their reservation was started in like 1910, so they had small herds, so they had horses. So, but I don't know where she's coming from, but maybe the fact that a lot of the Big Cypress area is wet, and she's talking about 1960s, and they haven't even dug the good canals yet to get the water off of them, and so they could have done it on footback or canoes. I don't know, airboat probably.
Okay, do we have any questions from the audience? We need to be wrapping up here. Questions about Seminole Cattle Ranching? Anyone? Well, thanks, fellas. And there'll be a roping contest right here at 4:30. And it's for first-timers as well as professionals. We had a few heavy hitters show up yesterday. One feller been roping for almost a week. He took 4 o'clock, right here. And we have fabulous prizes for all contestants.